And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpits, here's Nick Perez.
That's right, and welcome to Live from the Pulpit, the cutting edge in biblical exposition. With you on location in Modesto, California, home of the Davis Park Church of Christ. This is the fastest half-hour podcast in the West, where I, your humble correspondent, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez, offer up news and views you can use on Scripture and society, with a little help from my friends. Greetings, welcome to the program, glad you tuned in. Sponsor this half-hour, Christian Book Distributors. You know, as a preacher, I need good tools for Bible study. I'm going to be referencing a few different resources in this episode. And you can get all your Christian books at bargain prices through Christian Book Distributors. You have a large selection of Christian fiction, kids' books, Christian music, DVDs, books, both classic works and contemporary, and of course Bibles. CBD is sure to have exactly what you need. Go online and visit www.christianbook.com or call 1-800-CHRISTIAN. That's 1-800-247-4784. Christian Book Distributors, serving the Christian community for over 30 years. Today marks the 5th anniversary of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. 5 years ago today, a deranged young man walked into Sandy Hook Elementary School, armed and fully loaded, and he shot and killed 27 people, 20 of whom were first graders. First graders, the age of my oldest son right now. You know, by faith, we believe that God brings good out of acts of evil. And without a doubt, Sandy Hook is an act, or was an act, or several acts of evil. And so, therefore, by faith, we believe that God can and will bring good out of Sandy Hook. But we're left with the question, what good can come from the murder of innocent children? What good, God? What good is this? As I think about the grief that these parents endured 5 years ago and that they continue to endure as they adjust to the new normal of life without little Catherine or little Daniel or Jesse, I was reminded of another father who lived thousands of years ago whose son was taken from him. It is a story that we know, but I don't want us to focus on the main character of this well-known narrative. I want to focus rather on the main character's father. I want to walk through the story of Joseph with the eyes of Jacob, the bereaved father. I believe there are parallels between Jacob's experience and the experience of the parents who lost a child at Sandy Hook. And I believe that the story of Jacob points us in a good direction for answering the what good question. We know the Joseph story. It's recorded for us in Genesis chapters 37 and following. All the way to the end of the book, essentially, is the story of Joseph. But it starts with his daddy Jacob. His daddy Jacob grew up in a dysfunctional family. Best way to describe it. His mother and his father played favorites with the children, which were Jacob and his twin brother Esau. Isaac loved Esau because he was a man of the field. Rebekah loved Jacob, the smooth man. And that had devastating consequences on the family. Jacob perpetuates that dysfunction. It seems he played favorites with his sons. Joseph was one of just two sons that were born to him through Rachel, the only woman he ever really loved. His other children came by way of Leah, a woman he was duped into marrying by his father-in-law. And Bilhah and Zilpah, which were the handmaidens of Rachel and Leah. He plays favorites. He gives his son Joseph the coat of many colors, the many ornamented coat. And then this pretentious adolescent proceeds to brag about his delusions of grandeur. That aggravates his brothers. They want to kill him. They change their mind, and instead they sell him into slavery. Only it turns out that his delusions of grandeur aren't delusions at all. They're visions from God which come to fruition while Joseph is in Egypt. He rises from the prison to the palace to become second only to Pharaoh. After 7 years of plenty, there are 7 years of famine, and when the famine is at its worst, Joseph saves the world. Even his ne'er-do-well brothers are saved by Joseph, and after a bit of theater, he's reunited with his father, Jacob. The whole family comes down, but you have that touching moment with Jacob especially. Now, that's the story we're most familiar with, but have you ever considered the story through the eyes of Jacob? In Genesis chapter 37, verses 32 and 33, after the brothers have sold Joseph into slavery, they bring back a coat, the coat that was Joseph's, that they have dipped in the blood of a goat. They bring the bloody garment to Jacob, and in verse 32, they sent the robe of many colors, brought it to their father, and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not. Please identify the garment. Is it Joseph's or not?" I'm sure they brought it with as much feigned grief as they could muster. I'm sure they put on a performance equal to what Joseph will do later on. And he identified it, says verse 33. Jacob recognizes the coat. It's my son's robe. Now, don't miss this. He then draws the conclusion. He deduces to a conclusion. He says, a fierce animal has devoured him. This isn't his ne'er-do-well sons feeding their father the lie. Jacob, the heel grasper, the deceiver, the one who's pulled fast ones on others, has a fast one pulled on him. It's a ruse. A farce. A fierce animal, a wild beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces. When he finds out that his favorite son has been slaughtered by a wild beast, Jacob begins to mourn and grieve, and he grieves freely. Verse 34, then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days, probably beyond the customary 40 days of mourning. That was the ancient Near Eastern custom. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He's inconsolable. Refusing to be comforted, he wraps himself in a blanket of sackcloth as he mourns. And he cries his eyes out day and night over the death of his son. The rest of verse 35 says that Jacob said, "No, I shall go to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Again, was it a ruse? Oh, yes. A fraud foisted upon Jacob by his other sons? You bet. We know that. We're the reader, okay? When we've read the story many times, and the thing is, though, that Jacob doesn't know that it's a ruse. He doesn't know, like we do, that just several short chapters later, he'll be reunited with Joseph. All he knows is what is in front of him, and he has concluded his son, Joseph, the son of the only woman he ever really loved, he's dead. Jacob, the heel grasper, the deceiver, he himself is deceived by his own flesh and blood. I mean, just think of the irony of this, that it is Jacob who crafts his own lie about Joseph's fate. He's dead. A tragic encounter with a wild beast. And then we see the real grief and the real anguish overcome Jacob as he experiences the death of his son. What good, if we just stop there at chapter 37, what good could come from this? And then I think about Sandy Hook. It was similar but different, of course. In his book, The Question That Never Goes Away, Philip Yancey describes the scene the day the shooting took place. It was related to him by eyewitnesses who were on the ground. The parents were asked to wait in a firehouse. They waited 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, four, without any information forthcoming. Like Jacob, they were asked to please identify what their children had worn to school that day. First responders asking them what their children had worn. After the 4 hours, the governor shows up. He visits, offers his condolences, shares his sorrow. And it's at this point that the bewildered and distressed parents press the governor for answers. Are there any survivors, they ask. He assures them that law enforcement is doing all that they can. They press him even more. Are there any survivors? The governor looks to his aide. He knows that he's stuck and he must be the bearer of bad news. And he tells them, these parents, if they have not been reunited with their child, it is not going to happen. That the children that are still on campus were fatalities. Fatalities, if you will, of a wild beast, a fierce animal of a boy. According to the governor's aide, the scene was horrific. You can imagine anger, sadness, sorrow, heartbreak. Some screamed, others fainted. Real grief, real anguish overcame the parents. We're told that the wails and the weeping and the mourning could be heard by people outside the firehouse. What good could come from this? What good could possibly come from this kind of evil? As I turn back to Jacob's story, I wonder what toll the loss of Joseph had on Jacob. What toll did it take? What effect did losing his favorite son, what effect did that have on Israel's faith? Was it similar to what the parents of Newtown, who lost a child, experienced? I wonder, did it drive Jacob from God, or did it drive Jacob to God? See, the thing about tragedy is it does call faith into question. In fact, Christmas Day following Sandy Hook, the New York Times ran an opinion piece that was titled, "Why, God?" Tragedy calls faith into question, but it can also affirm faith. You see, the alternative to why God is just why. The alternative is no God. We live in a cold, impersonal universe and events like Newtown are just the result of blind, pitiless indifference, and when you die, you are extinguished. That's the alternative. And parents like Jacob, parents who lost a child at Sandy Hook, they recoil at such a thought. You see, as Yancey says, in the midst of trauma, even a sternly secular culture recognizes the worth of individual human beings, a carryover from the Christian belief that each one reflects God's image. Maroslav Volf, a theologian, he drilled it down even further the day after Newtown when he wrote, "Those who observe suffering are tempted to reject God. Those who experience it often cannot give up on God, their solace, and their agony." In other words, those who are on the outside looking in, yeah, they're typically the ones who are asking why God, and they are tempted to reject God. But those who actually live in it, they know that the only place they can turn is God. And we recoil from the nihilist worldview, which says that blind luck and chance in an indifferent universe is what ultimately led to the total extinguishing of these precious little beings that day 5 years ago. We recoil. You recoil. So do I. Rightly so. We believe there is a God who can turn the night to day. We believe there is a God who can bring good from evil. And that brings us back to the question, what good can come from such unspeakable and heinous evil as the slaughter of 20 first graders and 7 adults? What good, God? And it's a tough question, and I don't presume to have all the answers. I want to offer a couple of possible answers. One that's not from Jacob, I believe it's still biblical, and another one from Jacob. The first that's not from Jacob but is still biblical is that every life is a gift from God. This is the good that can come from such unspeakable evil. Every life is a gift from God. The renewed and changed perspective of this truth. God is the creator of each one of us, body and soul. According to Zechariah 12 and verse 1, the Lord formed the spirit of man within him. When we die, according to Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 7, the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. And so, every life is on loan from the lender and will one day be returned to the lender. Emotional relief after the trauma of tragedy comes not just in the acceptance of the event itself. That's part of it. But it also, emotional relief comes with the acceptance of the gift of the often too short time that we had with the one who was taken. Acceptance is one of the 5 steps of grief. And I know they're not a list or a ladder, or, you know, the people experience the 5 steps in different order. But acceptance is one of them. And the good that can come from such awful evil, even as Newtown, is we come to accept that the life of this person, however long or short, was a gift. It's unfortunate that it's tragedy that has to bring this truth out. If we could understand this and grasp this while the person is still with us, that every bit and every particle of their life is a gift from God. Yancey relates the story of John Claypool. He's an Episcopal priest who wrote the book Tracts of a Fellow Struggler. Tracts of a Fellow Struggler. His 8-year-old daughter contracted leukemia. They fought it for 18 months, and then she succumbed to the sickness. And it's Claypool who writes about this, that every bit and every particle, what he learned and what he shared with his congregation was that every where he turned, he was surrounded by a reminder of her, the things we did, the things she said, the things she loved. And he would focus on that, and he would be reminded that that life, short though it was a gift. A gift that he was to be grateful for. And again, that's the emphasis of this. If any good can come from this, it's to recognize, come to accept that this life, the life of this person, however long or short it was a gift. I wonder if Jacob learned this, and this is why I'm hesitant to say that this comes from Jacob. His view of the afterlife was so limited. I mean, we're only in chapter 37 of the Bible. He doesn't have a full fleshed out view of the afterlife. But just based on the statement that he says, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. Or, as the New Century Version puts it, I will be sad about my son until the day I die. I don't know. That doesn't sound like the language of acceptance that leads to emotional relief. I think Jacob struggled with this. The second thing, and this is from the story of Jacob, I believe that we get just a glimpse, it's just a shadow of resurrection and reunion. You see, word comes to Jacob that Joseph is alive and that he is ruler in Egypt. This is Genesis chapter 45, verses 26 and 27. The boys come back from Egypt to the land of Canaan. They told him, Jacob, Joseph is still alive and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart became numb because he did not believe them. When Jacob hears that Joseph is alive, it's unbelievable to him, so much so that he's shocked, stunned by the news. But the evidence demands it must be true. You see, in verse 27, he says, when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. It's as though Joseph is back from the dead on the one hand, so there's resurrection, but then you also have Jacob, and his spirit was revived within him. It's as if he himself has been resurrected. They make the trek to the land of Goshen, and it's in chapter 46, verses 28 and 29, that Jacob and Joseph are reunited. He sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to show the way before him in Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. Then Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. He presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. There's a tearful reunion as the bereaved father sees his son for the first time in over 20 years. That's how long it's been. Depends on who you ask, but 22, 23 years, when you work the timeline out, that's how long it's been. And they weep for a good while as faith becomes sight. It's as if he has received Joseph back from the dead. And that's why I say it's just a shadow. And it's pointing us to a greater reality. You see, we believe that our Joseph, the Lord Jesus Christ is alive, and that he is King of kings who reigns forevermore from the heavenly realms. It is unbelievable. It's hard to believe. It's shocking, stunning news that Jesus was raised from the dead, but the evidence demands that it must be true. In the Message, a paraphrase of the Bible, in John chapter 1 and verse 14, a very well-known verse which says that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. In the Message, it's translated or paraphrased that the Word became flesh and moved into our neighborhood. What neighborhood did Jesus move into? What kind of neighborhood? In Matthew 2, when Jesus is born, verse 18, Matthew quotes Jeremiah 31 in verse 15. And it's a neighborhood of weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. That's the neighborhood into which Jesus moved. A neighborhood that welcomed his birth with the slaughter of children by a mad tyrant. Scholars estimate, by the way, that Bethlehem probably had somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 children. 20 children slaughtered by a wild beast of a man. By faith, we anticipate a reunion where God will wipe away all tears. When these days, which as Jacob calls them, they're few and evil, when these few and evil days of our life are over, by faith we believe that God and Christ will be united with them eternally, will be with them, and will see again the faithful departed. But this is only possible because Jesus came into the midst of the suffering. Yancey regularly says in his books that where misery is, there is Messiah. Where there is misery in the world, that's where you can find Christ. He comes to be in the suffering. We're not left by ourselves in a cold, indifferent, pitiless, blind universe. Rather, the eye of our Maker and the eye of our Father is upon us. And he is keenly aware and intimately involved in our world. And it's possible because, like Jacob, this reunion and this point where God will make all wrongs right, it's only possible because, like Jacob, God, he knows what it's like to lose a son. It's different, similar but different, because unlike Jacob, it was not a cruel ruse by sons feeling neglected. Rather, it was the tragic reality brought about by sons of disobedience. Yancey says this. He says, God knows something of the grief that Newtown feels, as well as that in every place name on the map of a planet soaked in evil and death. God knows, because he too knows what it's like to lose a son. I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. I always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit, like the Facebook page, and you'll get updates when I go live with a podcast, update the blog, or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit, and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Many of the Question of the Day segments are there for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, Live from the Pulpit. Download all the episodes to your particular iDevice, and you'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Follow me on Twitter, at InPulpit, at the letter N as in Nick, Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Same handle on Instagram. Be sure and stop with the Life from the Pulpit blog, L-I-F-E, from the pulpit.wordpress.com. All of my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, Ephesians, Philippians, stuff on the Psalms as well. Check out Davis Park Church of Christ website, davisparkchurchmodesto.com. DavisParkChurchModesto.com for more information. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.